Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Tom Piazza, whose new novel is A Free State. And Michael Murphy talks about Feared at New Orleans, a guide to the voodoo, vampires, graveyards, and ghosts of the Crescent City. Tom Piazza is one of the great journeymen of New Orleans writers. He does it all, from journalism and nonfiction to the finest fiction. You know him from his passionate manifesto, Why New Orleans Matters, his fine Katrina novel, City of Refuge, his short story collection, Blues and Trouble, and the music, writing, and essays collected in Devil Sent the Rain, Music and Writing in Desperate America. He wrote for the HBO series Tremé, and as far as I know, he's the only New Orleans writer to have won a Grammy. And that's for his liner notes to Martin Scorsese Presents the Blues, A Musical Journey. This fall is cause for celebration on many levels. Tom will be receiving the Louisiana Writer Award at the Louisiana Book Festival October 31st, and he is publishing his best novel yet, A Free State. Well, Tom Piazza, welcome back to The Reading Life.
It's great to see you, Susan.
Do we have any time left? You're having a pretty good year.
It seems to have gone by so quickly. What they tell me, but I'm enjoying it, certainly, yeah.
So talk for a moment about finding out you're the recipient of the Louisiana Writer Award. That's a rare honor.
Well, I was kind of bowled over, actually. Yeah, you know, I chose to be in New Orleans. I've been here for 21 years, and it's an incredibly gratifying thing to feel that, you know, in some kind of way, the place that you chose and that you adopted kind of adopted you back and chose you back. And incredibly gratifying to feel that my work that I've done while I was here is seen as being of value,
to
the culture, you know,
yes.
And a deep honor.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about A Free State. It ventures a bit far afield for you. It takes place in 1855. It's a story of a runaway slave, Henry Sims. And it feels so different to me. So tell me about Henry Sims and your change, your move toward this historical fiction.
Well, I became interested in that whole field of early American music, and in particular, what we call blackface minstrelsy.
Right.
Because I began playing the banjo about 3 years ago. Banjo really sucked me in, and I started doing a lot of reading about the history of the instrument. And you can't go very far in reading about the history of banjo before you come on a few very prominent facts, one of which is that the instrument in its earliest form was brought to the Americas by enslaved people from Africa. And then it became kind of the most common instrument that was played by enslaved people,
right?
Not just in the U.S., but in Haiti and other places where they ended up. And then also you come very quickly on its huge role as a kind of iconic instrument in what became really the first real vernacular indigenous form of American music, which was the music that came out of the minstrel show. And this is extremely rich and extremely difficult and extremely complex territory, because the music that was associated with the minstrel show was both African American derived, and also some of it sounded, from the evidence that we have, like Irish fiddle tunes, jigs, reels, what have you. So from the very beginning, American music was this kind of syncretic hash of African-derived and European-derived elements. And with it came this extremely bizarre phenomenon of white performers covering their faces with burnt cork and doing this sort of viciously caricatured and yet oddly admiring at the same time this really racist caricature of African-Americans, of enslaved people. And this was a sensation in American entertainment in the late 1830s, 1840s, 1850s forward, and well into the 20th century. The blackface minstrel show was this extraordinary popular phenomenon among white audiences.
Right.
So to get back to what you asked me, Henry Sims, the central character of this book, has escaped from the plantation where he was born and raised. The master, quote unquote, of the plantation is in fact his father, as so often happened.
Right.
As Henry is coming of age on the farm, there's an older enslaved person who works in the woodshop there, who's also a musician, who makes a very kind of rudimentary banjo. And Henry takes to this instrument. And in his loneliness and in a situation that is very difficult for many reasons, the banjo is a solace to him and also a way of being seen and differentiating himself in a situation in which everything is conspiring to dehumanize you as an enslaved person.
Right.
And he runs to Philadelphia, which is pretty much the nearest big city in a free state where he could get to and sort of be there for a while. So that's the soil out of which Henry grows, you might say. Right?
Well, and the other thing is that Henry is a reader, which I find so right. appealing to me, mm-hmm. and a great lover of Dickens,
yeah.
who was so wildly popular at this mm-hmm. time.
It should be said that was not a very common thing. It was
right.
more common than we might think, but it was still quite rare. And in the case of Henry's situation, his mother, who had been taught to read by the owner's wife, mm-hmm. now deceased, Henry's mother teaches him to read by reading through the Bible. And the master, of course, has a great library. He's a very cultured man, except when he's,
yes.
you know.
except when he's not.
Doing what he mm-hmm. does so well.
So Henry gets to Philadelphia and falls in with another kind of runaway, James Douglas, mm-hmm. in this minstrel troupe. And that is such a wild undertaking for that time.
Well, yes, wild and also illegal, which is why they have to concoct yeah. a kind of scheme for what turns into a kind of joint performance. The character you mentioned, James Douglas, he was raised in a small farm that with a very kind of constricting mm-hmm. Situation around him. And for him, as for Henry, for some of the same and some different reasons, music was a liberating force in his life. So James gets involved with this burgeoning phenomenon of minstrelsy and establishes a troupe of his own eventually in Philadelphia. And we sort of see him go through some of those steps.
Now, one of the things you do so well in this book, which I think draws on every part of you, and there are these wonderful descriptions of musical performances and the effect that they have on audiences. And I wonder if you'd read that passage where I think it's James goes to his first.
Sure. The passage I'll read is, as you say, from the first time that James actually encounters one of these blackface minstrels. And the character he goes to see is actually an actual historical figure, Joel Walker Sweeney, who is credited with adding a string to the banjo and was really one of the first popularizers of the banjo and of the minstrel music that was performed at that time. And James is very young, even before a teenager at this time. And he goes with his brothers across farm country in Pennsylvania to a tent, because that was the form of, obviously, entertainment at that time. When you were living in a rural area, you depended on itinerant mm-hmm. musicians, lecturers, what have you, to come through and give entertainment, circuses, whatever. So here is James sitting in this tent and watching, by plain lamplight, this performance of Joel Walker Sweeney. How to convey the atmosphere that settled over the tent. The swish his satin sleeves emitted as he switched and swung along the stage, the way his movements were timed and echoed the phrases of his songs and the banjo. He played at least six songs solo. I remember Lucy Long, Jump Jim Crow, and Jim Along Josie, before being joined by another fellow who played the bones and danced a marvelous jig dance. The songs beguiled me. They were full of improbable characters, tragic courtships, bullfrogs dressed like soldiers, talking birds. The sound of the banjo, part drum, part lute, set up an irresistible forward momentum, yet it constantly subverted expectation. Where you were led to expect a note, there would be an emphatic absence. Where you had been led to expect rest, you would be pushed forward into the next episode. The banjo constantly insisted, and, always more to come, never the possibility foreclosed, except playfully. I went into a kind of trance, as if he had cast a spell upon me, the shadows behind him, the proximity of all the other souls, the warmth of the evening. I was transported, lifted above the world and its tedium, as if a curtain had been pulled back and I had been told that all glory could be mine. He played for what seemed both an eternity and the most fleeting of moments. During a spell of especially riotous applause, Sweeney left the stage and I sensed a shift of some sort in the audience response. I returned to myself and looked around and realized that the performance was, in fact, concluded. People were getting up from their seats and making their way outside. We were being evicted from the circle of wonder and possibility and herded back into the lockstep of ordinary time.
I love that. I think that's so beautiful. But besides these gorgeous flights of beautiful prose, you created one of the most evil characters ever in one of your books, this evil slave hunter. And you must have gone to some dark, dark places. He's capable of great violence, great sexual violence, too.
Yeah, he's capable of pretty much anything. Tull Burton. You know, in doing this book, or preparing to write it, and in the course of writing it, I did a lot of reading. I became very intrigued by the subject, but you have to follow it where it leads. So I did a lot of reading about the Underground Railroad, about the history of slavery, about the history of Philadelphia, about the history of popular entertainment, all of that. You know, and the trick with doing that is you have to assimilate all this material that you encounter in doing the research and only use as much of it on the surface as the characters are really aware of. You know, there's nothing worse than doing a lot of research and then you can see it in certain books where people have done the research and feel like, well, they have to put it in there,
right?
You know. So, Susan, as you and I know, when the levees failed on August 29th,
right.
2000, you know, it's things that people wouldn't actually say to each other. So one of the books I read was a book on runaway slaves. Mm-hmm. It was partly written by John Hope Franklin, the great African-American historian. And it was very interesting reading about the people who made a profession of doing this. And the thing about Tull, though, he's not a generic character. You know, he's a hideous human being. There's no question about that. But one of the things that I found interesting about him was that he didn't have actual hatred for the slaves. They were sort of maybe a little less than human to him, but they weren't the point. The people he really dislikes are the slave owners with their sense of false aristocracy and their pretensions, you know. And of course, Tull, the slave hunter, knows the slave owners look down on him.
Oh, yeah.
So he has a tremendous amount of, you know, I guess today would say class resentment toward the slave owners. What happens with Tull, though, is he considers himself a professional with a code of ethics. And the one thing he can't stand is resistance to his will. You know, In any way. So if he's bringing a slave back, he's not necessarily going to be unduly violent just for the sake of it. But God forbid the slave resist or insult him or call his authority into question, and he becomes a complete psycho. Mm-hmm. It's funny, a friend of mine, David Gates, the writer, made note of that trait in Tull Burton and said, I've been reading a lot of the news out of, you know, Ferguson and other places. And he said, somebody who's a professional who can't tolerate any question of their authority, and a switch gets flicked when they're resisted and they're capable of anything. He said,
what does that sound like? Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's funny because, you know, you used the phrase historical novel earlier, which I'm sure is going to be applied to the book, but I truly don't think of it as a historical novel. As far as I'm concerned, everything that's in the book might as well be happening today.
Well, you do have those gorgeous little foreshadowings, a mockingbird singing on a statue, and a character named Atticus, character saying, I can't breathe. You read along and you shiver with that notion of what is to come.
Well, I think shivering is a good sign when you're reading a book.
I know, it's probably true. Oh, we've been talking with Tom Piazza, who's the author of the brilliant new novel, A Free State. You can meet him Tuesday, September 15th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Thursday, September 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And don't miss seeing him receive the Louisiana Writer Award at the Louisiana Book Festival October 31st at the State Capitol in Baton Rouge. Tom, congratulations and thanks so much.
Oh, thanks, Susan. This was great to see you again.
Michael Murphy is a New Orleans transplant who's growing deep roots here. And if there's a scale for passion for New Orleans, he goes right to the top. After a career in publishing and agenting in New York, he's turned to writing in New Orleans and about New Orleans. The charming Eat Dat was his first book, and now he's back with Fear Dat, New Orleans, a guide to the voodoos, vampires, graveyards, and ghosts of the Crescent City. Perfect as the scary month of October looms in our future. So, Michael Murphy, welcome to The Reading Life.
Welcome, and thanks for having me here.
Now, I love, love, love this book. It is so much fun. So how did you approach the scary parts of our city?
You don't have to approach them. They approach you.
Yes.
It's kind of all out there. I mean, this came about as an offshoot of the Eat Dat. Mm-hmm. Eat Dat, the publisher approached me to do a food guide, a restaurant guide. I convinced him, no, you don't want to do that. In the era of Urban Spoon, TripAdvisor, and Yelp, no one needs a restaurant guide anymore. But here we got stories. You know, every restaurant has a story. There's a lot of sidebars about various interesting people like Gerard Marat, who I didn't know before the book. And he's our Yoda. You know, amazing. Taught every chef in the city. And then it's done so well, you know, they started scratching back to do some more books. And so I thought, what are the three prongs that bring 9 million tourists here a year? Our food, our music, and that will be in 2016. Hear that.
Yes.
And then our dark side, our voodoo and vampires. And it was their choice to do this book second. And then it was an intense 3 months trying to pull this all together because I didn't come in with a great deal of knowledge. And so I had to read everything I could read, get out there and experience every tour, really get the voodoo history, etc. So it was intense.
And yet your first connection to New Orleans was via Anne Rice.
She's the one that brought me here at first. I was working for Random House at the time, and we had a very good natural relationship. And they sent me down here to work with her whenever any of the issues to resolve or iron over or bring peace to the stage. I came down the first time was in May of 83. And I'd never been in the city before.
Whoops, all over.
And then it became a cliche. I actually did a speech at the Cabildo about 10 years ago about the cliche of outsiders getting seduced by New Orleans, because by second day, I felt I was home. Perhaps you felt the same when you came here from Houston.
Yes,
I did. Or John Goodman or Brad Pitt or Tennessee. We can have a long list of people who are seduced by the city's charms.
So now you're showing off these scary parts of the city. So let's start with the vampires.
Well, vampires are heading in with Anne Rice.
Yes.
So I started there. I have one chapter called Hooray for Horrorwood, which is all about the many films and TV series made here in New Orleans. And the problem with this book, like so many, and Eat That, it was like, we have 1,400 restaurants. That's more than a book. And I left 250 are there. So it's like what to put in, what to take out. Same is true here for vampire stories and ghost stories.
Yes.
We've got thousands of them. So here it was again, like, because my books are not supposed to be exhaustive encyclopedia, the be-all, end-all. They are supposed to be primarily informative but amusing.
They
are the casual tourists
and
or people who live here.
And with lots of photographs.
Yeah, Rick Olivier did the first. Fabulous job he did on the Eat Dat. He did want to do Fear Dat. So in that one, I had the pleasure or nightmare of working with about 55 photographers.
Wow, that's
which
a
was
lot.
Like herding kittens, you know, trying to get the JPEGs in on time for the production. And the last 2 weeks, it was a total nightmare, and I don't want to ever do that again.
Now, one of the things that I love about these books is that you pick up so many interesting little things along the way. It's like you've counted up all 38 New Orleans cemeteries, which I found very helpful.
And been to them.
And with little guides to each one.
There's a story there, too. I had written up what I called the Bone Watcher's Guide to New Orleans, which are maps pointing out who's buried where. From Marie Laveau to Ruthie the Duck Lady. And it was supposed to be in the book. They finally thought, we cannot make these maps in the book and make the pub date of September 16th. So I'm doing it myself.
Wow.
I'm working with my designer who did my website, the cover of the book. We're going to do a little H-page brochure with the maps and a little annotation for all who's buried wherever they are, which I think will do fabulous. But that will be just me, not the publisher.
Yeah. So the other thing you do is throw in little bits of information that people might not have considered or thought about. Like, why are people buried 6 feet under?
This I didn't know until the book.
See?
I mean, it started, you know, the Great Plague in Europe and Mayor of London claiming that's how they had to be buried, you know, so the infections wouldn't come to the surface. And also there's the belief so that wolves and dogs wouldn't dig them up to eat them and they start smelling just ripe for animals.
Oh, well, here in New Orleans, we should have that show and call it 6 feet over.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
6 feet above, you know.
I think by law, by the insurance companies, it's 4 feet right now, isn't it?
Like
in your housing,
sure.
If you're 4 feet above water, you get better insurance, even though the flood was 14 to 20. It wouldn't make any difference to the house.
Now, the other thing, this will show you what a book can do. I will never be able to look at Lafayette Cemetery again in the same way, because you talk about how 7,000 people are buried in that small little space.
You can fit a lot of people into each vault.
I know.
When you're down to Asher, easy to move around.
It's just like, here's a small town that I walk by, you know, fairly often. And, you know, gives you a little shiver when you think about
it,
really.
Like, I'd never been to St. Rock before doing this book. What a gorgeous spot in our city. Just beautiful.
So was that your favorite discovery of all?
I don't know about that, because there's discovered so much. Mm-hmm. Really, it's the people. I mean, these books, whether they sell or not, have served me, because it gets me deeper into the city I love. I met so many crazy people for Fear That.
So tell us about Carrie Roy.
I love her. I wanted to have profile one psychic. There are many psychics. She's the number one rated psychic in America. And as I say in the book, you go into her office, which is in the warehouse district, and it looks like an accountant's office or a marriage counselor. There's nothing woo-woo about it. There are real psychics out there.
Mm-hmm.
I've experienced many hokey ones, including ones I published back in my publishing days, and you go on tour with them. And by the third city, I was furious, because some woman that the author was talking to would start crying. It's like, oh, honey, you know, she's not reading your dead mother. She's reading a script.
Oh, God.
And there are a lot. That's probably most of them. But occasionally you'll bump into someone. In New York was a woman named Mary T. Brown, who blew me away. Just the stuff she said, I have to accept their ways to get knowledge I don't understand. Then she made a prediction, which I thought, I don't know what that means. And 2 weeks later, it was right there in my face.
Well.
Carrie, too. She made a prediction. It's like, oh, that doesn't make any sense at all. And 2 weeks later, there it was.
Wow.
Arthur Raymond Smith may have been my favorite find. I wanted to find a grave digger. And I finally found this Arthur Raymond Smith, who is a grave decorator. When his mother died, he had the idea just to decorate and honor the graves, the two women who really raised him. And if you go into St. Louis number one, immediately to your left, about four graves in on the wall, there'll be this big purpley-pink grave, and that's his grandmother's. His mother's, and if you go into Holt, you'll see all these elaborate carpet remnants, you know, shopping carts from grocery stores and weird statuary. That's old Mr. Arthur. And that's, he takes his mission. That's, he's just kind of wanders around gathering things and decorates his graves. He was a delight.
We love to decorate things here in New Orleans. Now, another thing that you do so well is talk about Halloween as a great New Orleans celebration. And I recall your family trick-or-treating at my house one Halloween.
Of course.
In a particularly marvelous getup.
I was a waiter at Goulatoir's. I was sort of a zombie waiter.
You look very special.
Thank you very much. And my wife, Marnie, was Bride of Langenstein's. So she was sort of this Frankenstein creature with all sorts of food items in her head.
Yes.
And we want our daughter to be Emeril Lagasse, which seemed to be perfect. Try as we might, she went out just as your standard everyday vampire.
Well, you're going to have a lot to live up to this Halloween with this book, you know. So talk a little bit about the Halloween celebrations and why you think it is so much fun here.
Because it's New Orleans. I mean, on anything worth doing is worth overdoing.
Yes.
So we've got three vampire balls. One just won't do. And State Street at Halloween is a treat. There was one year we wanted to do the Halloween parade in the quarter. And of course, when it says it takes off at 7:30, they mean like 9 o'clock. And she was getting upset because she really wanted to go to State Street, which is the prime trick-or-treating.
Oh, yeah.
So we thought we need to run to get the St. Charles streetcar. So we were running down Bourbon Street until she stopped. She said, Dad, this is highly inappropriate. Because bourbon on Halloween is a little bit risque.
It's the dilemma of the New Orleans child, you know.
This year, I probably won't be doing it because with this book, I'm pretty booked solid.
Yes.
Halloween Day, I will be at Garden District Bookstore in the atrium doing all sorts of Halloween-y things. The day before, I'm doing the Words and Music Festival, doing a sort of a ghoulish table discussion.
And not only that, you have an update to Eat Dat coming out in November.
November 5th.
Eat Dat Up.
Eat Dat Up Dat.
I know, I love that.
Because it's just, there's so many new restaurants.
I know.
I got 35 new
in there. You can't turn your back
on
this town for a minute. It changes.
And you can't lose any weight here either.
No, that's true.
But I found so many great new ones.
We've been talking with Michael Murphy, whose new book about New Orleans is Fear Dat. You can meet him Wednesday, September 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Tom Piazza, signs a free state Tuesday, September 15th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Thursday, September 17th at Garden District Bookshop. Melinda Rowe signs Of the Rising Tide, a photo essay of the vanishing bayou community of the Ile de Jean Charles, Tuesday, September 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Michael Murphy, signs Fear Dat New Orleans, a guide to the voodoo vampires, graveyards, and ghosts of the Crescent City, Wednesday, September 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Garth Stein signs the paperback edition of A Sudden Light, Wednesday, September 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Matthew Gwynn signs The Scribe, Thursday, September 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Photographer Richard Sexton presents a slideshow and discusses the work from his book, Creole World, Thursday, September 17th at 7 at the Nix Library. Leslie Zemeckis signs Goddess of Love Incarnate, Friday, September 18th at 2 at Octavia Books. Local agent Pamela Gray Ahern and authors Farah Roshan and Candace Proctor discuss the value of traditional publishing at the monthly meeting of the Southeast Chapter of the Romance Writers of America, Saturday, September 19th at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The 6th annual one-day conference Salon de Jeanne d'Arc takes place Saturday, September 19th from 10 to 6 at Loyola University. Featured speakers include Dr. Janet Lynn Roseman, author of If Joan of Arc Had Cancer, Finding Courage, Faith, and Healing from History's Most Inspirational Woman Warrior, in a workshop that's open to all, but especially geared toward women with cancer. Xavier University professor Dr. Amanda Helm discusses brand identity in medieval times, heraldry, and guild signs. Alex Labrie signs his book of photographs, Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc, and the complete schedule is available at joanofarcparade.com. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Modern Baptists by James Wilcox, Saturday, September 19th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans begins its year of reading Nicholas Nickleby. The first meeting is Saturday, September 19th from 2 to 4 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. Start with the first 10 chapters. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, September 20th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Christina Vella signs George Washington Carver, A Life, Monday, September 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. Laura Kelly, author of The Irish in New Orleans, discusses Hidden Histories of New Orleans, The Irish, at the monthly meeting of the Genealogical Research Society of New Orleans. That's Monday, September 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And coming up, the Women's National Book Association celebrates National Reading Group Month at the New Orleans Museum of Art, Saturday, October 3rd. Authors appearing include C.S. Harris, author of Who Buries the Dead, Tiffany Kwai Tyson, author of Three Rivers, Richard Wall, husband of the late author Carol Wall of Mr. Ouida's Guide to Gardening, Kent Wascom, author of Secessia, Karen White, author of The Sound of Glass, and John Ed Bradley, author of Call Me By My Name. Free, except for the author tea in the afternoon. All book groups are welcome. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.